Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Our topic today is evidence-based policymaking in disadvantaged places. To begin with, Meg Kaufman, project manager at the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth, is going to set out the background to the project and its findings.
The Disadvantaged Places project came about because at the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth, most of our advice to places tells them how to build on the strengths that they already have in their local economies and how to make their economy stronger. But there are some places in the UK where there is so little economic activity and the population has such a large number of people who are long-term unemployed. They've developed all kinds of social and health problems that mean that in some ways they're very far from the labor market. I like to use this quote from Michael Storpert to describe the problem. He said at the City Horizons events in 2018 that any program that tries to spread prosperity has to deal with these accumulating negative social externalities, schooling, health, behavior, despair. There's of course a chicken and egg interaction, but what we know is that if the social fabric deteriorates, people are not in a position to be productive, no matter what employment you bring to them. I think he describes very well that situation where there are people that even if a big employer were to land on their doorstep, they would not be in any position to move into employment. This is a problem that we've been thinking about at the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth since the beginning of our work, really. And we knew that we had to reach out to other professionals in order to address it. So we approached the other What Works Centres, the seven original What Works Centres, and asked them to partner with us. Those centers are the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, the Early Intervention Foundation, the What Works Center for Wellbeing, the Center for Aging Better, the College of Policing, and the Education Endowment Foundation. And we asked them if they would be willing to collaborate with us to look at the problems in these most disadvantaged places and see what kind of advice we could provide to them about where to make a start. All of the What Works centers prioritize the use of robust evidence in their advice. So although we all have different standards of evidence, we're used to working with each other. And we were really looking forward to seeing what bringing together all the different professions would provide in terms of advice. The most important partners in the work were places. We wanted to find two places that fit into this definition of disadvantaged places, but that also had the ability to work with us, to host us for two visits, to do a lot of background work and preparation and analysis about their own economies and their own populations. And we did some profiling and came up with 20 places that were among the most disadvantaged in the country. And then we approached Wakefield and Grimsby and asked them if they would be willing to work with us. And they were both very keen to collaborate, and we are very grateful to them because not only did they host us for these rather large visits, but they spent two full days of staff time working with us and really listening to the questions that we were asking. And really, I think, being very honest with themselves about what they were good at and where they still needed help, which was incredibly valuable. We came away from Wakefield and Grimsby, I think, with four clear impressions about the kind of problems that these disadvantaged places are dealing with. And the first of all was that there weren't going to be any simple solutions. The staff and even the third sector organizations in these places are quite overwhelmed. They've had a lot of budget cuts over the past 10 years. The staff in these places, at the councils as well as at third sector organizations, are quite overwhelmed. They've had severe budget cuts over the past 10 years, and many of them are struggling just to keep up with the work that they have. Evidence use is patchy. So while some departments seem to be using good evaluation or even the evidence base, for example, the Education Endowment Foundation's toolkit was being used by schools in Wakefield, there were other departments that didn't really know that there was a good evidence base out there that they could be drawing on. And so we felt like we needed to get our message across more clearly. And that was our sort of third finding about simplifying our messages. With seven different What Works centers, all taking different approaches, it can be very difficult for people coming to our advice fresh. So we need to find a way to communicate more clearly. Finally, we felt that although we usually encourage places to try new things and to evaluate rigorously, in the case of the most disadvantaged places, really they're so overburdened that what they need to focus on, we think, is what we already have some sense does work, things that we know will provide benefits, rather than always trying new things. Many of these places have had far too many short-term funding solutions or short-term projects to take on, and it saps the energy of the staff there. And really, we should be experimenting in places that have more resources, like Manchester and London, and using the findings of those experiments to help the more disadvantaged places. The product, really, of the project was a set of principles to improve outcomes. And in many ways, this is not new. These are tried and tested good policymaking practices. But what we've tried to do is put them into a very short document. It's only about 10 pages. And give a light touch advice to places that they could easily pick up and implement. We came up with 6 principles to help improve outcomes, the first of which is being clear about your objectives and how you're going to define success. The second was some light guidance to making better use of data. The third is about how to access the evidence and how to take a baseline reading of what departments in your council are using evidence and which are not. The fourth is about tailoring and targeting and timing your interventions so that they can have the greatest impact, but also get the best value for money. The fifth is about measuring success, not the robust evaluation that we would really like to see places doing, but about much more light touch monitoring. And the final message is about sharing what you learn. Even when a policy is implemented and doesn't work, it can be very helpful to let other places know that you've tried it and it failed. They can learn from your experience, which is invaluable. We also produced 2 pieces of evidence-based advice. They were like toolkits, and they drew across all 7 of the centers. One of those focused on mentoring, and the other focused on reminders. And these were 2 areas where we were aware that disadvantaged places could really benefit. We hope to do more work on this subject in the future, particularly around some of the evidence-based advice. The collaboration with the other WhatWorks centers was brilliant. And the multidisciplinary approach is going to be essential for helping disadvantaged places make progress.
I'm now joined by Professor Henry Oberman, Director of the WhatWorks Centre for Local Economic Growth, Eleanor Stringer, Head of Strategy and Policy at the Youth Futures Foundation, and Mike Hawking, Policy and Partnerships Manager at Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Welcome to you all. So we're going to take on the points that we heard Meg talking about in relation to the project itself, and the findings and all the rest of it. But I suppose my first question to you, maybe to you, Mike, is, you know, when we think about the policymaking challenge, is it significantly different when we think about disadvantaged areas and places?
I think the simple answer is yes and no, which we'll hopefully delve into a little bit. But I think the first point to really get into is picking apart what we mean by disadvantaged places, because this report has focused on learnings from Wakefield and Grimsby, but actually some of the poorest parts of the country are in the middle of our city centres. And I think it's really important to recognise that different types of places are disadvantaged for different reasons, and really understanding that context might then influence the type of policy making you do. So, for example, Wakefield is on the edge of Leeds, a big major core city. Grimsby is obviously not, and it is a port town. And I think how policy applies and is affected in those places will look different. That's not to say you can't draw from similar lessons and similar learnings. It just means that it might land differently in those places.
Yeah, Ella, what's your thought on this? And you know how we think about policy. Does it feel and operate differently in more disadvantaged places or less disadvantaged places?
Yes, and there is a good answer to that. Because I think the challenge is at a local area, for local authorities, it's hard to do evidence. Well, it's hard for any policymakers to do evidence-based policymaking, let's be honest, because there's all these other pressures. And any local area, be it a disadvantaged or a less disadvantaged one, is going to have lots of other priorities. So whilst we might sit here in London and think, oh, it's more important for disadvantaged areas to be more evidence-based in their policymaking, they're going to have many other things that they're thinking about. And I don't think that the less disadvantaged places are necessarily any better at this than those ones that we're talking about in this report.
Henry, your thought on this? Because part of the origin for the Growth Centre to get interested in this was because we felt that, you know, there was something weaker in terms of the economy, which meant that other issues needed to be brought to the table.
Well, I think that's right. I think from an economic point of view, these places are grappling with particularly tricky problems because, you know, there is an issue for them that the economic challenges that they face are reinforced by the social challenges that they face, and the social challenges that they face are reinforced by the economic problems. Now, you know, of course, that's true to some extent everywhere, But I suppose if you took a poor disadvantaged community, say out in the East End of London, you know, there is something different about the fact that, you know, they are a mile and a half from a huge concentration of jobs, you know, one of the largest concentrations of jobs in the world. And so I suppose that there is a sense in which these sort of places that are, you know, somewhere away from those sort of areas which are doing relatively well, you know, do struggle somewhat. And I suppose you make the point that, okay, you know, Wakefield sort of sits next to Leeds, but still, you know, there's still less there for Wakefield to build on than perhaps there might be for a community, you know, in London. So I think that, you know, the way in which those challenges reinforce one another does mean perhaps there is something slightly, you know, more pronounced about the problems they face. Now, having said all of that, you know, I do really think that there's lots we can learn from other places. So context isn't everything.
Yeah. So, Mike, can we pick up on that? Because I think, you know, we identify the kind of issues around sequencing on the one hand, trying to A, understand the nature of the problem or the challenges, breaking them down in some respects. But then when we think about how we might do them, you know, sequencing of different types of initiatives with whom, when, and how, seem to me to be one of the kind of critical issues, particularly when we are dealing with economic and or social issues all at the same sort of time.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think where I would really support Henry's views, when it comes to sequencing, that actually might be similar in many different places, regardless of where the place is. I think where the challenge comes to is then how you would design policy making. So, for example, a person with a multiple complex health problem in Grimsby and Wakefield, you may want to try and develop a system of sort of health intervention. When it comes to getting them into work and then progressing those people into work, particularly on the progression side, it might look quite different. Because, you know, in work progression in a larger city like Manchester, where there are more clustered jobs and more opportunities, might be slightly easier than it would be in a place like Grimsby. So how would you design something which would benefit that individual?
Yeah.
That's where I think the difference might be. So the sequencing might be similar, but it's then when you get into the policy detail that it might look different.
Yeah. And what's your thoughts on that, Ellie? You know, because it's a sort of balance between, you know, the context and the specificity that's required versus, you know, general principles or general approaches.
I suppose at the Youth Futures Foundation, we've mostly been thinking about it from the position of the young person.
Yeah.
So a young person with multiple challenges may say they've got, I don't know, they've been brought up in care or they've got special educational needs and disabilities. They may look relatively similar if they're in Grimsby or in Westminster, but it's just when you've got more of them in one area and more of these additional challenges is where the issue comes in. So you might be able to say something quite general about what helps these type of young people, but then the challenges Mike said is then when you come into the detail of how you put that in place in a different area, then you get multiple differences.
Yeah. Henry, what's your I mean, on the context specifics versus the generalizable?
Well, I think those are both nice examples that we've just had. So, you know, I suppose let's imagine thinking about criminality. I assume that there are some parts of the country where gangs are a much bigger issue than other parts of the country, and that's something to do with the concentration of, you know, youths and others who are, you know, getting into crime. And similarly, you know, Mike's example says, you know, is one where, well, you know, it does feel slightly different if you've got a concentration of, say, entrepreneurial businesses which offer people chances to progression versus being somewhere where that isn't the case. But then, you know, flipping it on the other side, you know, I suspect that, let's imagine that we think that mental health problems are a real barrier to just participating in the labour market at all. And I suspect we think that actually there's quite a lot of commonality in that across areas. And there, you know, it really is the case that, so if our primary aim is to get people ready for work, that supporting them to deal with their mental health problems, now those problems may well look pretty similar wherever you are, right? Now, look, they might be different for a young single mother versus, you know, a teen who is on the boundary of crime, you know, and has dropped out of school. I mean, those, well, clearly the interventions might look different for those two sets of people. But You know, there's going to be more that unifies how you want to deal with those people. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's this idea that these concentrations of or particular characteristics of the areas might interact with the treatment, but not losing sight of the fact that actually quite a lot of what matters is the individual characteristics and the challenges people are facing. So it's finding the right balance between those two. I
mean. What's your thought on, I mean, you mentioned the scale effects, you know, where there's lots of, you know, the issue or the challenge in a place, how does that then change the way that policy is able to respond or think about that?
And it is a bit more complex than I said, because if you've got an area with a lot of young people in the care system, that does not just multiply the challenge by the number of times more bigger that population is. That does then change how you have to respond at a system level. Right. So it depends. For an individual young person, what you might want to do might look similar depending on whether there's a small care population or a large one. But actually, from policy making at a local authority level, the response is going to have to look different.
And in what way? What's your thoughts on that? That's an interesting point around, it's not just adding one extra. There's something then that the scale effect kicks in, and exactly. The nature of the response needs to be quite dramatically or at least reasonably significantly different.
Yeah, because there are externalities and spillovers. I suppose part of this does come on to, we haven't used the kind of R word, resources yet. If you've got an area where you've got a much larger population, well, let's continue that example of being in care or of being in the offending system, they're going to be already sucking up a lot of time and energy and attention from the local authority and from local civil society. So that then gives you kind of less spare capacity to do anything more, like think about their future job outcomes or their future life success, because you'll just be concentrating on working with them at the moment.
Yeah,
and actually that's the resourcing issue is really important, but also then the purpose of a place and the function a place plays is critical too, because for example, if you have a place which has lots of very cheap housing, then what has tended to happen is that other local authorities might use that place to house some of their population, because they can't afford to house them in their own location. So that, what that means is that further concentrations disadvantage, and it further concentrates some of the really intense social problems that we have. So one of the problems that Blackpool has, for example, is that people actually remember that as a really happy place, and if they're really struggling with complex health issues or complex mental health issues, they'll sometimes go to the place where they've been happiest, and that might be Blackpool. And that means that Blackpool has a lot of people coming there with very complex issues. Similarly, because it's a place that has lots of older B&Bs that might have been converted into private rented homes, it becomes a place where lots of people can live quite cheaply. And because of the function that the place ends up playing, because of the housing market, because of other things, you get very intense concentrations of complex problems often. That doesn't happen in other places where the housing market's different and the place might play a different role. And I think sometimes we're not particularly good as a country in thinking about the different types of places play in local economies. Mm. And that some actually are attracting people because of housing markets or other things with very intense problems.
I think the interesting thing, reflecting on those two points, is that even though the concentration story isn't enough in and of itself, because I was thinking there of the example that we sometimes get when we go around the country, where you'll go to a local authority and the local authority will say, unemployment is really high in this local authority, and therefore we think that we should reduce the conditionality requirements on people who are unemployed. So, you know, at the moment we insist they come into the job centre X times a week or X times a month, but there aren't any jobs locally. So, you know, why are we doing that? So we should adjust the policy because the problems here are particularly concentrated. And actually, you know, the evidence suggests that would be the wrong response, that actually it's very important to think about the conditionality requirements in some way separate from the level of unemployment in the local labour market. At least that's the state of the evidence that we have. that says actually, you know, for getting individuals to, you know, back into the labour market, it's actually rather important that we're getting them in on a regular basis, you know, face to face, and that the idea that suddenly you would go somewhere else and say, well, just because unemployment's high here, actually, let's only see them once a month, you know, we're going to waive that. That would be the wrong thing to do. So there is something about looking for situations where, and you use the word externalities, you know, where there's something non-linear, or, you know, there's some sort of effect that we see that really does mean that the concentration means that we should change the policy response. I think sometimes that's going to be the case, but sometimes it's not. And I suppose, you know, that's not a very satisfactory answer, but it does emphasise what work centres say. Well, you have to look at the evidence to figure out whether your context really justifies doing something completely different or whether you can learn from other people. I think flipping it around, you know, there is a little bit of a danger that in lots of these places that we go to, they think they're so unique that they can't learn from other places. And I don't think any of us around the table would countenance
that. You hear that on occasion, don't you, in a sense. We are so very different, and in partly that is there's truth to that, that actually generalizable statements or principles don't apply to us because we're incredibly unique. Obviously, everywhere is incredibly unique, and they've all got their thing to say. So, how do we address that? We can't deny their feeling of, or their observation, or their statements that they are unique, but we also need to think about how some of those principles can be applied even with a bit of tweaking. Right.
So I go back to my point about understanding the context of different types of places. So a core city is going to be different from a seaside town. There won't be different contexts, but a core city and another core city will have enough similarities that they should be able to learn from each other. Similarly, seaside towns can learn from other seaside towns about what they're doing. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be any transfer of knowledge between those two types of place, because obviously, as Henry's been saying, there's lots of learning that you can do, but I just wonder whether we should actually start to think about grouping some of the types of places and the functions that places play in different local economies, and actually see if there's ways for them to learn from each other, and it might then start to dissuade some of that notion that we're so different, we can't learn from anyone else.
No, quite.
So I think often places can look quite similar on data, like you say, there might be the cities will look quite similar to each other than smaller towns or outreach. But what we found, YFF, we've been going around speaking to people working on youth unemployment in different places, and where we agree that different places are unique is who the right actors are to help solve a problem in the local area. Because in some, the local authority might be very strong, actually, and have a great role to play. Or there might be an incredibly good youth employment organisation locally who has great partnerships and great networks with the job centres and the health services and the care services and all the right people. Whereas in another place, there might not be that same strong one organisation, and it might be down to a kind of smaller network. So even if on the data level they look similar in terms of their populations and issues, that response and who needs to be brought back together to find solutions is going to be different. So they are right to say they're unique in that respect.
Yeah, and that's okay, Henry.
Well, I think there's elements of the answer in both of those. So, you know, if you think about what we do when we evaluate programs and we try to figure out what works. You know, we're quite comfortable with the idea that we might that the effects of a specific intervention might be different for different types of people, right? So, you know, we do that all the time. You know, you'll see these analyses, for example, in employment training, where we say, is the kind of employment training you get, would that be different for someone who is short-term unemployed versus long-term unemployed, right? So we categorize people into two different broad types and say, okay, you know, would the intervention differ depending on the characteristics of the people? So this sort of goes towards Mike's thing of saying, actually, you know, it sort of fits with the way that we come at it on an individual basis to say, do we think that it would be different for London versus core cities versus market towns versus coastal communities? Actually, you know, that I'm quite comfortable sort of framing things like that and thinking about it. But, you know, the lesson that we found, even from, say, Grimsby and Wakefield, was that, you know, to Eleanor's point, that actually the different parts of those local authorities, you know, worked in different ways in different places. You know, so I was really struck in Wakefield, for example, with the fact that the fire, the one from the
fire resilience,
they were busy piloting making every contact count type initiative, because clearly someone was interested in the fact that, you know, if you had a fire in a vulnerable person's home, could they come in and spot this? Now, you know, I mean, we're not actually, maybe Grimsby was doing that, but it didn't come up there. So you suddenly see, okay, hold on, you know, in Wakefield, we've got this fire department that is incredibly interested in experimenting, you know, with these kind of things and thinking about putting people into, you know, mental health support. Whereas I don't know, in Grimsby, where I didn't visit, but I got the impression, you know, that there was a technical college that, you know, was really interesting.
Yeah.
And that people came away with, you know, quite a sort of set of very striking images from that meeting. So, you know, it is the fact that I'm actually, when you start playing out those things on the ground, the places can vary a lot in terms of which bits of the local authority are functioning. You could imagine which schools are working, which are, you know, there's a lot of variation there that makes it more complicated.
And it feels like it would be incorrect to go to other left behind places, disadvantaged places, and say, what you need to do is get your senior fire officer to be really interested in making, because that's not what you're trying to replicate. You're trying to replicate the making every contact count approach. It doesn't have to be always that exact person or organisation.
And actually, what you've touched on there is the importance of local leadership and identifying where that local leadership comes from and exists. Something that we've often talked about and policymakers have often looked at is an asset-based approach. So something which looks at where are your strengths as a place, where is the local leadership coming from, and how can you try and corral that into something coherent. And I think there's really, really something clear in that, how you can encourage leadership to use evidence and to really think through how policies are applied. And in a lot of places, it doesn't really matter where that's coming from. You're right, in some places it might be the local authority, in other places it might be another institution that is driving something forward, and that's all right.
But I think, you know, the point, exactly, I mean, the interesting point around, you know, recognising and then thinking carefully about the capacity of the institutions, whoever they may be, in a place to essentially respond to or react, because we often ignore that in a sense when we think we identify the issue. We may even decide that we want to introduce more resource in terms of cash or whatever it is into that place without really thinking about whether there are institutional arrangements that can actually make good use of that and, you know, are well organized in order to do it. I think it's always the thing that tends to be missed in many respects. One of the things I think is interesting, get your thoughts on it, was in some of these places, not all places, but in some of these sort of, you know, identified disadvantaged areas, they become hotspots for experimentation, piloting, you know, the latest, greatest new initiative. You know, in a sense, when we were in Grimsby, you went to, you know, Wakefield, you mentioned Blackpool. In some respects, they are awash with things that are being introduced in their areas, all for good reasons. But there's kind of questionable. Well, firstly, I think, get your thoughts on, you know, are these the appropriate locations for experimentation? If they are genuinely experimentation, to what extent do we think we're learning from, you know, from an experiment? In a sense, I would suggest it has to be, you know, you have to learn from it in order to be an experiment. Or whether these places are actually, by the virtue of the challenges, these should be the places where we're mainstreaming stuff that is tried somewhere else, at least, and then we know that it's working. But, I mean, Alan, there's a lot of in there, but, you know, sites of experimentation, appropriateness, well, you know, what do you think about that?
I'm going to bring in some of my lessons from, I've been working for the past 8 years at the Education Endowment Foundation, undertaking hundreds of randomised controlled trials in schools. And whenever we had schools involved with our trials who were Ofsted rated as inadequate, there were always problems. Those schools did not have the capacity to implement the programme we were trying to evaluate effectively and to take part in the trial effectively. So I'm not saying that schools and areas are the same, but our experience from them is, you know, they've got so many other things coming at them. And if I learned anything from my 8 years at EEF, is that implementation really matters. And so you have to have that capacity and that headspace and that resource to implement it well. So it may well be that the most disadvantaged places, if they have those challenges, are not best placed to do that. But I'm willing to hear otherwise.
So I've got two quick thoughts on this. One is that the fact that lots of places are end up having to do different trials of things might actually be more of an indictment of national policymaking than it is of the fact that these places haven't done lots of trials of things. Because if you're in a place and you've got multiple complex problems and you want to do something about them and you haven't got cash to do it, but you see this new government initiative which is going to give you some cash to do it, you're going to jump at it.
Yeah.
Now, if what we instead we think is, well, we should get and show those places with multiple complex problems have the resources in order to tackle them, then we should just give them resources in order to tackle them rather than make them jump through hoops to constantly get onto different trials or different test beds. What that doesn't mean necessarily is they shouldn't become places where you test things, because going back to that local context, we need to know what works in a major city, whether that's different to whether it works in a coastal town or a market town or a former industrial town. There will be differences. And I think learning from national programmes such as Universal Credit, for example, which did take that approach and tested implementation in different areas, for all its failings, that was an important thing that it did. So it's important you do tests in lots of different places, and we shouldn't discount the fact that some of this is actually just about resourcing at the moment. So some of the lessons that we might be taking from that is because of the current state of play in resources, rather than actually thinking about what would a good experimentation type process look like.
Yeah, no, quite, Henry.
Let me park the resources thing for a second, because I do think it's really important that we come back to it. I actually was thinking about this since the event that we had where we launched this, and reflecting on comments that we got on the day. I think what I was sort of getting at is that experimenting with lots of new innovative approaches, that just doesn't feel like what we want these places to be doing. But we don't want to assume that stuff is necessarily going to transfer from elsewhere, because we've just been talking about the fact that the context matters, etc. So I do think, though, that there is a distinction there between experimenting, right, where we're really saying, I've got no idea whether this approach is going to work or not anywhere, right? So, I'm taking a brand new idea and I'm going to go and run and see whether it works. Now, to me, building on Eleanor's point, if I've got a really a new pedagogical approach, test that in schools that are capable of testing, right? For whatever, because they're resourced properly or whatever that is, that there's these differences. So we test that and then we find it works. Now then, it is clearly an important question, would this then apply in a school that's struggling, right? Or, we've trialed employment training or, face-to-face versus online advice, right? We've trialed that somewhere, and now we're sort of saying, okay, now when we take that to this disadvantaged place, does it work as well? So I think that I separate out sort of, complete trialing of new experimental approaches versus, well, we need to experiment with the kind of policy delivery that we're having in these places, but we should be experimenting sort of within the set of things that we have a feeling are going to work for these places.
Yeah.
And that actually, I suppose, now then, there's a technical distinction here, but then is the appropriate thing monitoring or experimentation when we then transfer that to another place? I think you can make the case either way, actually. I do think that experimentation, proper experimentation, where what I mean by that is, we trial it with some people and we don't trial it with other similar people. That's a very powerful tool for figuring out what's working. But actually, with some of these disadvantaged places, I might be willing to take a monitoring type approach, which just says, well, look, we trialed this thing in a school and we saw these better outcomes for kids. So now let me just, relative to some kind of control group, so now let me just take that thing, put it in this school and see for the kids, the group of kids that we're now doing this for, are we seeing similar effects on that group of kids? And if we are, okay, actually, then it feels to me like I'm sort of willing to say, well, yeah, all right, then this is an intervention that does seem to generalise and be usable in these places. So I think that's an important distinction.
Because go back to the EF example, and just follow that through as to whether, what you were seeing was these genuinely, we don't know whether these things need to work, you have to kind of figure out, or were your comments about stuff that had kind of worked somewhere else, but you wanted to know whether it worked in that particular context?
Yes, generally when we were trialing EF things, they had some evidence behind them, but the actual programme didn't. So for one of those, we were testing it for the first time, and like I say, testing that in schools that have recently been rated inadequate by Ofsted and therefore having lots and lots of other priorities and help and issues thrown at them, I don't think was right. And to that point about if you've tested it elsewhere and then you're bringing it to a place or a school that is more disadvantaged, would you need to experiment again? For once in my life, I would say the focus then shouldn't be on experimentation and randomization or, you know, proper impact evaluation, but the focus should really be on what can we do to make sure it is being implemented and delivered properly in these schools or those more disadvantaged places. Because I think the temptation, again, thinking from a school's point of view, is to say, okay, that thing works, oh God, we should do it, let's just kind of ram it in and just do it. And they don't actually train the teachers in the proper way. And so they're doing it in name, but they're not actually delivering it.
So I don't disagree with any of that, but I think what's interesting, and to pick up on the schools example, you might have an outstanding school in a really disadvantaged area. That feels like a place that you could experiment on. So there are outstanding schools in Wakefield. We could definitely do things to experiment, test things there.
That's where the analogy between schools and local authorities doesn't really work.
Yes.
Because you're right, I was talking about schools who've been failed by Ofsted who may well be in more advantaged
places. Yes, yes.
Whereas a local authority may be disadvantaged on many levels, but in actually a very high-performing, high-functioning local authority.
Precisely, yeah.
Yes, it's tricky, isn't it? Because actually, I think where this is coming from as well, so now this does get us onto the resources thing, which is that now let's imagine, you know, pick any one of the, you know, of the disadvantaged local authorities. So I'm in no way going to say which ones I think are good or bad, right? But, you know, Wakefield and Grimsby were two local authorities from disadvantaged places that were very keen to engage with the evidence base and with the project. But even there, I think that their resources are so constrained that I would still have my primary focus being on trying to see whether cost-effective things elsewhere worked for them. So again, it's one where perhaps the school analogy doesn't work quite so well because, you know, actually school resourcing, if anything, is slightly more generous to the ones that are have a more disadvantaged intake, for example, through the pupil premium, etc. So I think that even for local authorities, you know, who do have the capacity and are interested in engaging with the evidence base, I still think, given what we've seen in terms of resourcing in those areas, I still think that I lean towards the advice I would give them to be saying, okay, look around for stuff that's worked elsewhere and then see whether it works in your context would be my first port of call, rather than you sort of thinking about experimenting and stuff. Because I think we have to recognise that there are resource costs to experimenting, you know.
And they may be responding to a set of circumstances they find themselves in. You know, the point that you were making, might, you know, in a sense, if external money is primarily available only for experimentation and piloting of new stuff, and you're resource constrained, you're going to go and get that money. So they may be responding to that. But it does still seem to me to be in places they are still happier to pilot and experiment new stuff rather than necessarily introduce stuff that has been done somewhere else and say, we might need to tweak it slightly, but actually, yes, we agree, you know, these are the things that have been tested out and therefore we're going to think about how we can implement them and roll them out.
My gut is that it's probably more responding to the framework that is operating, but I don't discount the fact that there will be definitely places who are going, you know, I want to test this, I want to work this out for ourselves. Our circumstances are so unique and so different, then we're going to do that. But I generally do think that most places are actually responding to the external environment and saying, we need to get some money to do stuff because we're really being pushed in other ways. I know, for example, in Wakefield, they are looking at an in-work progression type scheme that learns from Oldham. So it's not, there are things going on,
yeah,
like that quite regularly, but yeah, I do accept that there will be places that.
And Ellen, your time at EEF, going back, I mean, did you find that schools were more willing to engage in doing new stuff, or more willing to engage in essentially implementing stuff that had been done somewhere else?
It's a really good question, and I don't think there is a an easy answer one way or the other. Schools like doing things that they've seen other schools do and do well.
Right.
Actually, I think schools are kind of more willing to do that.
I think that's right.
Than local authorities. What they did care about it with was often whether it kind of aligned with their own way of seeing the world, their own school values and ethos and their head teacher's approach.
The idea that you learn from peers, you know, you look around and you gave the example, oh, look, Oldham has got an in-work progression scheme that's really good and that works, right? Okay, how do we know this? I mean, really, that's the whole point about the experimenting, etc. I mean, quite often you see this thing where, you know, a local area will introduce an innovation, then of course they're going to go, you know, they often go around and say it works. Now, what's their metric for working? Actually, it's a little bit to some of the stuff we were discussing earlier. It's not really whether or not it made a substantive difference. You know, it's about whether it got funded and, you know, whether the people have come through the door and the money's got out and it's seen as a success by the people that are involved in it, etc., etc. So I think there's a natural dynamic that leads people to looking at what peers have done and the statement that peers made. I mean, it is amazing how often when we go around to local authorities, everywhere I go, they say, we've got this really excellent scheme that was amazing success. And you say, great, you know, let's have a look at the evaluation and the monitoring. And they don't have it. Well, I'm not saying that monitoring and evaluation, you know, is the only metric by which a local area is ever going to judge the success of its program. But, you know, there is a sense in which people like going to this peer thing rather than going to these sort of generalisable things. It might actually be back to Mike's point a little bit, that they look for programmes in similar places, so they're doing the topology thing in a way that we don't. I think the other thing, which I think is pretty understandable, is that there are lots of people within local authorities who have a huge amount of expertise, you know, who have a lot of practical expertise, who see services that they feel are not succeeding, who really care about the fact that, you know, they're not succeeding in the way that they would like and have interesting ideas about how they might want to improve them. Now, you know, as a national policymaker, when you do that, what do? You set up some new fund or whatever and you get places to bid in. You know, as a local policymaker, if you've got an interesting idea, where can you experiment? Well, you can experiment within your local area. So there's something about the sort of evidence ecosystem where we're not very good at extracting the innovative ideas that people within local government and third sector organisations have, and thinking about ways to experiment with that at scale, right? I mean, it's completely different if you're in central government. You come up with some sort of new thing that you think you would like to try. You know, contrast, say, business basics with a big grant, you know, say, okay, you know, we'd like people to experiment with this. Now everyone bid in and we'll resource this. You know, imagine being a, you know, local, you know, business support organisation that wants to do that. You're experimenting in your place or nowhere, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think the business space is actually an interesting example of central government actually trying to crowdsource ideas for experimentation. But I don't think that happens in many places. And actually, to be fair, quite a few of the What Works centres are doing similar. You know, I'm sure that some of EEF's ideas for training come from talking to teachers about things that they think might work. And then EEF takes those ideas and says, okay, how would we pilot them in a collection of schools to figure out whether or not they work?
Yeah. But then I suppose, you know, what are the things that would make a difference if we wanted to up the level in terms of the use of evidence in designing policy, never mind the use of evaluation in evaluating the policy? Eleanor, you wear two hats, so we already know one hat, but tell us about the other hat and just give us a sense as to the, you know, the challenges and the issues in relation to taking that step back, be more reflective. What does the evidence say when you're in a kind of very immediate context?
Yeah, so I wear many hats. Like I say, I've been working at EEF for 8 years, talking about evidence non-stop. Youth Futures Foundation, which I'm helping set up, has a very big focus on understanding what works for youth unemployment. So I've just commissioned an evidence review about that. And I'm used to having challenging conversations in my day job along the lines that Henry was saying of, hang on, you said this thing worked, did it really work? I'm also a local councillor for an Outer London Borough with cabinet responsibility. It's only in the past 6 months about cabinet responsibility for schools and adult education. I do not have many conversations about evidence-based policy. Let me be brutally honest. Because in that past 6 months, we've had a huge overspend in our budget that's like turned up and got bigger. We've had two Ofsted inspections. We had the Ofsted review of our SEND services and one of our adult education services. I've had one of my schools that were already in the academy go into another. There were things going on every single day and every single week that require immediate discussions, immediate solutions. We've got to find a load of savings for next year. I'm not meant to call them cuts, I'm meant to call them savings, you know, for next year. So, and this isn't to say, I do think my borough cares about evidence, pays attention to evidence. I know that the Children's Services Department have been involved with the early stages of the What Works Centre for Children's Social Care, for example. But from a leadership policy setting perspective, I do not have the space and the team do not have the resources to kind of take a stop, take a step back and say, oh, hang on, are our services and policy set out in a way which are best informed by evidence?
And so, I mean, get Henry and Mike's kind of reflections on that broader question, but just is that a resource constraint issue? You know, you're saying, you know, we know local authorities over the last decade have been, you know, have had significant amounts of money withdrawn from the system. You know, biggest area of hit up, you know, in the public sector for certain, and sustained over that period. So, is it resource constraint, or is it more than that in terms of the context of the institutional arrangements that are there? You know, the demand for targeting or for measuring or for performance standard. I mean, what is it? I mean, other than that, is it only you just don't have enough money to do this stuff?
So, resource is a big bit of it. There's another bit which is, I think everybody is still at the beginning of an evidence journey. Mm-hmm. We use the word evidence a lot within my council discussions, but it's normally evidence that the schools have improved because the GCSE results have gone up. And I know with my real hat on that that's not, you know, impact evidence, and we can't attribute that to any one thing. But there is that constant demand for, like, say, target performance measurement, which we have to keep an eye on. And we can't say... So I think, for example, this year our progress aid looks like it's gone up a little bit, and I'm going to make a big deal out of the fact that it's gone up a bit, little bit, even though I know that statistically it's pretty meaningless and we're probably exactly where we are last year.
Yeah.
Because that's what, you know, when you're talking about a local area and keeping everyone motivated, keeping the rationale going, you have to just constantly focus on, are we doing what we're meant to be doing well?
Yeah, no, quite. Mike?
So... I think there is something about the resourcing thing here, and I'd say, but it's not necessarily just about resourcing, it's about where places choose to put their resourcing. So at JRF, we have places coming to us, and most often it's like, so we've read your evidence, looks really good, what does that mean for policy? And they want us to do that translation bit and help them with that. We get other places coming to us and say, your evidence is great, we've translated into this. And it's because they've got that capacity to turn evidence into policy that it becomes really important. And that does differ depending on the size of place. But it also depends on where places have chosen to put their resources. Some of it does come down to resourcing and leadership. I'm also a school governor, and schools are obviously going through some quite hard challenges at the moment. And because of the new Ofsted framework's been put in, we, as a governing body, we've started to look at what that means for our teaching and learning and what we should be doing. But we've had to postpone, we've now had it, but we've had to postpone that meeting a couple of times because actually there are other more pressing issues around the budget that you need to look at. Mm. So it's one of those things, I think people do get that evidence-based policymaking is really important, but you need to make sure you have the time and capacity to do it, to really do it properly.
Understandably, there is, you know, something more immediate and more pressing that invariably trumps it at any given moment.
Exactly, and I think it's why the sort of What Works Centres are important, it's why organisations like JRF are important, because we can present stuff, we can present evidence and say, actually, you should be looking at at this stuff. Yeah. And the more accessible and the more easily available we can make it, then the less time hard-pressed officers have to actually do that the work themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Henry?
Well, there's a real challenge there. I'll pick up on the last point first. There is a real challenge there. I was really struck when we started doing this project, you know, which is a fairly small sort of project. We had never sat down as a What Works network and tried to pull together our advice, right? So one of the things that we did you know, for the report was saying, all right, look, lots of people are talking about reminders. What do we know about reminders across the What Works centres? And what do we know about mentors across the What Works centres? And that's the first sort of time we'd sat down and just tried to pull that together. And actually, I think there's lots of other things that we could do. I can really see, you know, if you are a local authority, you know, struggling to sort of pick, struggling with all kinds of crises, you know, managing challenges, etc., that, you know, the idea that you go to like 8 different What Works centres evidence bases, you know, read what each of them says on reminders, where you have to play through their differential evidence standards, etc., etc., and then you go, you know, Mike's got something, and, you know, all of these other, that's not very helpful, actually. So I do, you know, I do think that there is a challenge there onto those of us who are sort of working on pulling together the evidence. But these are old problems, by the way. I mean, I saw one slightly snide set of commentaries on social media in response to the report about how it feels like it's back to the late 1990s, you know, the Blair government. Well, hell, I think they would, you know, I think going back to our world where we had more arguments around effective interventions and cost effectiveness, etc., I can live with that. But, you know, it is a bit depressing. I do think there's, you know, there is a sense in which that criticism is a bit valid, that I think the evidence ecosystem has advanced. I still think there's a major challenge in translating this in a way that's sort of useful for, say, local authorities that are thinking across a range of things. The other thing, though, that I would say, which is flipping the challenge around a little bit, is, you know, I've always been a moderate on the localism argument. You know, I sort of see some arguments for localism, but I also see some arguments against. So, you know, when you take, for example, using evidence, you know, the capacity to use evidence imposes a sort of fixed cost, right? You know, you've got a resource, you've got, you know, you maybe need a chief economist and a chief social worker and a, you know, a chief social policy person and some analytical people around them, etc., etc. And these people are going to support what you do, but they're not directly responsible for policy delivery. You know, there is a reason why we get lots of those people in central government. Quite a lot of those people, well, quite a lot, but, you know, relatively speaking, a lot of those people in GM or West Yorks or GLA. And there's a real reason when you come down to, you know, a local authority for a small coastal community, you don't have any of those people. You know, there is a sense in which, you know, that is actually why we've tended to lean towards saying, well, here's what we think we should do with the curriculum, or here's how we think you should teach, or here's what we think conditionality should look like, and we're going to just impose that everywhere. Because although we accept that there should be some variation around this, really determining what that variation should be is too tricky.
I was going to say something similar about there's much more that national policymaking can be doing to help local authorities to do evidence-based things. Like I say, I'm not sure where I stand on the kind of localism, centralism thing. But as an example, Mike talked about the kind of new Ofsted curriculum. So all schools up and down the country are now focusing more on their curriculum. And its intent and its impact and its implementation because Ofsted wanted to. Personally, I think the Ofsted curriculum is relatively evidence-informed. So I think whilst there are many challenges for different schools in how they understand and implement it, I think it is encouraging them to focus on the right things. Similarly, another education example, the introduction of things like the phonics screening test encourage schools to use an evidence-based approach to teaching reading phonics. There's probably many more examples of where when central government is giving out its funds to local government, whilst I don't want to put a load of strings around them, it could say, well, maybe something like troubled families is a good idea. It could say, look, this money is meant to be spent on finding your highest need families and doing these sorts of things with them because these are broadly based on evidence.
In some areas, you know, education to degree, health for certain, you know, there is very clear, both clear guidelines and which are evidence-based, you know, to a reasonable, if not significant degree, but also on the implementation side, there's a response in the sense that, you know, you're doing these things or you get into trouble, as it were, or you get hauled on over the course. But in other areas, labour market interventions, economic development, right? I mean, there's no push there and we get no, then therefore places are not responding because they feel they don't need to. They just get on with doing the stuff that they kind of want to do, really.
Yeah, and actually, I think Henry's point is really quite important about, you know, there is a reason why some of the big urban centres have this capacity, and that's because they're willing to put the resource into, but they can also attract people who understand evidence-based policy making. They can attract the economists to work there. If you're in a smaller coastal community or something like that, and you're a local authority looking to recruit a senior economist, the talent pool you're going to be recruiting from is going to be quite small. You're going to have to be trying to get someone from elsewhere to move to your place, and that's just harder to do. So even if you're a really ambitious local authority wanting to do this stuff, it might just be harder.
Yeah.
And I think there is, I do wonder whether there is an element of where we've got really excellent leadership in places, that's because it's just happenstance that there is an individual who is really passionate about that place and wants to really make a difference about it, and they've got the skills and abilities to really drive this forward. But if you're trying to do it the other way and trying to find that person, then it might be much, much more difficult to do.
So how do we, you've alluded to it a little bit, Ellen, but I mean, how do we then move beyond, you know, hoping that there are more exceptional individuals in more places that kind of get it and then drive drive other individuals and institutions to get on board? But what's the structural response?
So I do think there is a role for central government here, and I think Henry's sort of argument about being a moderate localist might be quite interesting there, because what is the role for a government department who's got some of these really talented people to say, well, can we second people to some of these places to really help them? You know, you're facing this challenge, we're putting some cash into it, why don't you have some of our staffing resource to really help that through? Now, that might not necessarily mean moving whole government departments or whole people to different places around the country, but it might actually just help to bring that dialogue along. I mean, I'm really struck by the local industrial strategy development process, actually, and the fact that departments have been working with identified people in local authorities, with identified people in central government, and that has made some difference. But there's still a capacity issue there, because they could maybe do that up front with Greater Manchester and West Midlands, because they're only doing two at a time. But you're trying to do local policy making across the country all at the same time, then even central government doesn't have that resource that they can just work with everyone at the same time in an evidence-based way.
Yeah, Henry.
You know, an interesting thing to reflect on here is, in this debate about the sort of central versus local, is that, you know, if we think about local authorities at the moment, you know, the budget cuts they have faced are so pronounced that if you give them any money at the margins, it's going to go on meeting their statutory obligations around social care. So instead of properly resourcing our local authorities and allowing them to think about what their priorities might be and how they use the evidence base, you know, we've got local authorities cut to the bone. And then when we want to do something about, say, high streets, you know, we introduce some new central fund that they now have to use their scarce analytical resource bidding to, because back to Mike's earlier point, it's a source of money for doing something. So, you know, we just got ourselves in a terrible situation with local authority, you know, with where we've got to with local authorities versus central authorities. We've always been round and round on this, you know, as a country, you know, what's the appropriate measure? You know, we had some decentralisation, devolution, which I, you know, was fairly sort of supportive of, this sort of urban devolution approach that earlier governments have been taking. It's just all completely stalled. Mm. Austerity hasn't helped with this, and of course other distractions haven't helped with this. So we are in a little bit of a limbo, actually. You know, I think it's very, very hard for local authorities under the resource constraints they're facing to engage with evidence base. Government, you know, officials in government recognise that, and in an attempt to help them, their solution is, here's a ring-fence fund, you know, and I don't necessarily think that is very helpful, although actually, if you think we need to do something around X or Y, it is one of the only routes through in a world where any additional resource is going to go on meeting statutory duties, yeah. Right? So, you know, there's a real fundamental structural problem, for, you know, because I think lots of people in local and central government are very keen to improve the cost effectiveness, but structurally, we're set up in a way now that they're facing such profound challenges, it's really rather difficult for them to do very much about.
And just the sort of converse to my earlier point, which is that if you are a minister of state in central government and you find a problem, that you want to solve, you're going to want to try and tackle that in some way and also get the credit for it. And that's understandable from that person's point of view. So the desire to say we've got a problem with high streets, let's set up a high streets fund, is there. It does exist. But if you just said, right, we've got a problem with high streets, our solution is just to fund local authorities in a blanket way, there's no guarantee that you as that person or you as the department will get recognised for doing that as well. So we are in, there's a really interesting tension there. Henry said we've been over this quite a lot as a country, but it does exist, and we do need to sort of remember that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we're having this sort of conversation, well, we're having this conversation amidst a general election period. Oh joy, you can hear everybody cheering as of that. And notwithstanding the points that have been made, the need for investment into disadvantaged areas or left behind places, disadvantaged people, you know, whatever the terms that we use, you know, the need for that, for investment into these places and people is definitely not going to go away. And in fact, in many respects is increasing, as is the pressure on politicians to be seen to respond, you know, in the sense that you have to be seen to be doing something, which is right, you know, in the sense something most definitely needs to be done. So I suppose in kind of closing, what would we want to say to them, to those politicians, you know, not in the white heat of electioneering, because, you know, the nuance and the reflection and all the rest of it that we've talked about is not for an election, you know, process. But, you know, whoever wins is going to have to address these issues in some shape or form. You know, what's our collective or, you know, wisdom and view on what would we ideally like them to be doing when they're having a moment of reflection before events get the better of them? Mike.
Good question. Thanks for going to me first. So I think that, so if you were coming in as the new Secretary of State for Housing, local government department, the one thing I really push is to think through the challenge between, or the difference between funding investment in things and funding revenue streams. Because so some of the work that we've done at JRF about speaking to people and trying to understand the priorities of low-income voters, and we did some focus groups across the country earlier this year. Some of the things they were talking about when it came to things like the state of the high street was as much about cleanliness and services that are provided there, which aren't necessarily going to be solved by fixed funding pots, because, you know, ensuring that you have enough road sweepers to keep high street clean is a revenue issue. And I think that's where I would focus priorities, in that difference between funding things on a one-off basis and funding things on a revenue basis. Mm.
Yeah, Henry.
I think I would tend to agree with that. I've said this many times before. You know, part of the problem that we have in these places is that we like to do infrastructure investment and shiny things, you know, shiny buildings, shiny science parks, etc. I just don't think that is, you know, where that would not be the first port of call for my money. I mean, you know, that would not be where I was spending it. I was struck actually when we were launching the report that someone sort of said, "Wow, we just got to get in and invest in anything." No, you know, no, that's not right. Actually, we do need to think about the challenges that these places are facing. And, you know, I do actually think, ironically, that quite a lot of the stuff that we've cut viciously is, you know, it's coming back to haunt us, because actually it is around education outcomes for their kids. It is around, you know, mental health issues and other challenges that they're facing. I mean, and actually, back to Mike's point, you know, these are problems which many poor families are facing. I mean, it's just that these disadvantaged places have got a concentration of them.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I actually think that these sort of big, shiny infrastructure capital projects are very, very expensive. And we're just predicated towards that when we do these funds. And I would actually really like to see some of that money moved away from, you know, big shiny projects and actually towards things that I think that the people in these places are crying out.
Yeah, because typically on these kind of things, you get elders, you know, those sorts of funds typically have a, you know, what, a 90-10, 80-20 split, right? Capital being the 90 or the 80, and then a bit of revenue, you know, thrown in on the side just to keep people
reasonably happy, whereas it's probably, in some respects, you ought to think about the reverse. About 80, but a significant amount of revenue relative to capital.
So just very quickly on that point, there's a really great example in transport here, because the gut is always to fund rail infrastructure because that's the big shiny thing. But when you actually speak to people in a lot of these places, it's the buses. And actually, buses are, it's revenue funding. It's not capital funding. So how do you ensure that revenue funding can go to the places to support a really good bus service versus introducing a very expensive new line which might help a relatively smaller number of people?
You'll always find a fan in me. Anybody that says anything about buses positively always gets a thumbs up from me. And a final thoughts from you on, you know, what would we encourage our reflective new politicians, new government to be doing?
I'm tempted to say buses just to get
yes. You can never say too much about
the
buses.
The legitimate point, I was going to say two things. One is, everyone needs to recognise, it's so obvious that local authorities are here to serve a whole range of people, to treat a whole range of outcomes. But most of those funds, these kind of additional bits of money that you're talking about, or if everyone's focused on one thing, can everyone just think a bit more laterally? So when you're thinking about investing in your high street, don't just think about, yes, some buildings, but also think about, well, hang on, how can we also use this to invest in the skills of the local labour market or our local unemployed people? If you're thinking about investing in buses, think about, okay, well, where do we need the buses to be to benefit our most disadvantaged communities who are most at risk from the labour market? And don't just think about the kind of one immediate outcome that you want, but the kind of wider effect it can have on the local economy. And my second point is, I've spent most of my life in the charity sector, and in the charity sector, we've kind of won the argument that if you're giving a grant, you don't just give the project costs, you have to give some money towards the core costs of like running and doing the admin for the thing. And you'd be a very bad funder if you don't do that. I don't think central government's got that message yet, that when you're giving money to a local authority to pass through, there's a lot of admin involved in just passing through that money and to do it in an evidence-based way.
My guest today have been Henry Overman, Eleanor Stringer, Mike Hawken. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.